The Path of Duty. I. His brilliant prospects dated from the death of his brother, who had no children, had indeed steadily refused to marry. When I say brilliant prospects, I mean the vision of a baronetcy, one of the oldest in England, of a charming 17th-century house, with its park, in Dorsetshire, and a property worth some £20,000 a year. Such a collection of items is still dazzling to me, even after what you would call, I suppose, a familiarity with British grandeur. My husband isn't a baronet, or we probably shouldn't be in London in December, and he is far, alas, from having £20,000 a year. The full enjoyment of these luxuries, on Ambrose Tester's part, was dependent naturally, on the death of his father, who was still very much to the fore at the time I first knew the young man. The proof of it is the way he kept nagging at his sons, as the younger used to say, on the question of taking a wife. The nagging had been of no avail, as I have mentioned, with regard to Francis, the elder, whose affections were centered, his brother himself told me, on the wine cup and the faro table. He was not an exemplary or edifying character, and as the heir to an honorable name and a fine estate was very unsatisfactory indeed. It had been possible in those days to put him into the army, but it was not possible to keep him there, and he was still a very young man when it became plain that any parental dream of a career for Frank Tester was exceedingly vain. Old Sir Edmund had thought matrimony would perhaps correct him, but a sterner process than this was needed, and it came to him one day at Monaco. He was most of the time abroad, after an illness so short that none of the family arrived in time. He was reformed altogether, he was utterly abolished. The second son, stepping into his shoes, was such an improvement that it was impossible there should be much simulation of mourning. You have seen him, you know what he is, there is very little mystery about him. As I am not going to show this composition to you, there is no harm in my writing here that he is, or at any rate he was, a remarkably attractive man. I don't say this because he made love to me, but precisely because he didn't. He was always in love with someone else, generally with Lady Vandeleur. You may say that in England that usually doesn't prevent, but Mr. Tester, though he had almost no intermissions, didn't, as a general thing, have duplicates. He was not provided with a second loved object, understudying, as they say, the part. It was his practice to keep me accurately informed of the state of his affections, a matter about which he was never in the least vague. When he was in love he knew it and rejoiced in it, and when by a miracle he was not he greatly regretted it. He expatiated to me on the charms of other persons, and this interested me much more than if he had attempted to direct the conversation to my own, as regards which I had no illusions. He has told me some singular things, and I think I may say that for a considerable period my most valued knowledge of English society was extracted from this genial youth. I suppose he usually found me a woman of good counsel, for certain it is that he has appealed to me for the light of wisdom in very extraordinary predicaments. In his earlier years he was perpetually in hot water, he tumbled into scrapes as children tumble into puddles. He invited them, he invented them, and when he came to tell you how his trouble had come about, and he always told the whole truth, it was difficult to believe that a man should have been so idiotic. And yet he was not an idiot, he was supposed to be very clever, and certainly is very quick and amusing. He was only reckless, and extraordinarily natural as if he had been an Irishman. In fact, of all the Englishmen that I have known he is the most Irish in temperament, though he has got over it comparatively of late. I used to tell him that it was a great inconvenience that he didn't speak with a brogue, because then we should be forewarned, and know with whom we were dealing. He replied that, by analogy, if he were Irish enough to have a brogue he would probably be English, which seemed to me an answer wonderfully in character. Like most young Britons of his class he went to America, to see the great country, before he was 20, and he took a letter to my father, who had occasion, apropos of some pickle of course, to render him a considerable service. This led to his coming to see me. I had already been living here 3 or 4 years, on his return, and that, in the course of time, led to our becoming fast friends, without, as I tell you, the smallest philandering on either side. But I mustn't protest too much, I shall excite your suspicion. If he has made love to so many women, why shouldn't he have made love to you? Some inquiry of that sort you will be likely to make. I have answered it already, simply on account of those very engagements. He couldn't make love to everyone, and with me it wouldn't have done him the least good. It was a more amiable weakness than his brother's, and he has always behaved very well. How well he behaved on a very important occasion is precisely the subject of my story. He was supposed to have embraced the diplomatic career, had been secretary of legation at some German capital, but after his brother's death he came home and looked out for a seat in Parliament. He found it with no great trouble and has kept it ever since. No one would have the heart to turn him out, He is so good looking. It's a great thing to be represented by one of the handsomest men in England. It creates such a favorable association of ideas. Anyone would be amazed to discover that the borough he sits for, and the name of which I am always forgetting, is not a very pretty place. I have never seen it, and have no idea that it isn't, and I am sure he will survive every revolution. The people must feel that if they shouldn't keep him, some monster would be returned. You remember his appearance, how tall, and fair, and strong he is, and always laughing, yet without looking silly. He is exactly the young man girls in America figure to themselves, in the place of the hero, when they read English novels, and wish to imagine something very aristocratic and Saxon. A bright Bostonian who met him once at my house, exclaimed as soon as he had gone out of the room, at last, I behold it, the mustache of Roland Tremaine. Of Roland Tremaine. Don't you remember in A Lawless Love, how often it's mentioned, and how glorious and golden it was? Well, I have never seen it till now, but now I have seen it. If you hadn't seen Ambrose Tester, the best description I could give of him would be to say that he looked like Roland Tremaine. I don't know whether that hero was a strong liberal, but this is what Sir Ambrose is supposed to be. He succeeded his father 2 years ago, but I shall come to that. He is not exactly what I should call thoughtful, but he is interested, or thinks he is, in a lot of things that I don't understand, and that one sees and skips in the newspapers, volunteering, and redistribution, and sanitation, and the representation of minors, minorities, what is it? When I said just now that he is always laughing, I ought to have explained that I didn't mean when he is talking to Lady Vandeleur. She makes him serious, makes him almost solemn, by which I don't mean that she bores him. Far from it, but when he is in her company he is thoughtful, he pulls his golden mustache, and Roland Tremaine looks as if his vision were turned in, and he were meditating on her words. He doesn't say much himself, it is she used to be so silent, who does the talking. She has plenty to say to him. She describes to him the charms that she discovers in the path of duty. He seldom speaks in the house, I believe, but when he does it's offhand, and amusing, and sensible, and everyone likes it. He will never be a great statesman, but he will add to the softness of Dorsetshire, and remain, in short, a very gallant, pleasant, prosperous, typical English gentleman, with a name, a fortune, a perfect appearance, a devoted, bewildered little wife, a great many reminiscences, a great many friends, including Lady Vandeleur and myself, and, strange to say, with all these advantages, something that faintly resembles a conscience, too. 5 years ago he told me his father insisted on his marrying, would not hear of his putting it off any longer. Sir Edmund had been harping on this string ever since he came back from Germany, had made it both a general and a particular request, not only urging him to matrimony in the abstract, but pushing him into the arms of every young woman in the country. Ambrose had promised, procrastinated, temporized, but at last he was at the end of his evasions, and his poor father had taken the tone of supplication. He thinks immensely of the name, of the place and all that, and he has got it into his head that if I don't marry before he dies, I won't marry after. So much I remember Ambrose Tester said to me. It's a fixed idea, he has got it on the brain. He wants to see me married with his eyes, and he wants to take his grandson in his arms. Not without that will he be satisfied that the whole thing will go straight. He thinks he is nearing his end, but he isn't, he will live to see 100, don't you think so? And he has made me a solemn appeal to put an end to what he calls his suspense. He has an idea someone will get hold of me, some woman I can't marry. As if I were not old enough to take care of myself. Perhaps he is afraid of me, I suggested, facetiously. No, it isn't you, said my visitor, betraying by his tone that it was someone, though he didn't say whom. That's all rot, of course, one marries sooner or later, and I shall do like everyone else. If I marry before I die, it's as good as if I marry before he dies, isn't it? I should be delighted to have the governor at my wedding, but it isn't necessary for the legality, is it? I asked him what he wished me to do, and how I could help him. He knew already my peculiar views, that I was trying to get husbands for all the girls of my acquaintance and to prevent the men from taking wives. The sight of an unmarried woman afflicted me, and yet when my male friends changed their state I took it as a personal offense. He let me know that so far as he was concerned I must prepare myself for this injury, for he had given his father his word that another 12 months should not see him a bachelor. The old man had given him carte blanche, he made no condition beyond exacting that the lady should have youth and health. Ambrose Tester, at any rate, had taken a vow and now he was going seriously to look about him. I said to him that what must be, and that there were plenty of charming girls about the land, among whom he could suit himself easily enough. There was no better match in England, I said, and he would only have to make his choice. That, however, is not what I thought, for my real reflections were summed up in the silent exclamation, "What a pity Lady Vandeleur isn't a widow." I hadn't the smallest doubt that if she were, he would marry her on the spot, and after he had gone I wondered considerably what she thought of this turn in his affairs. If it was disappointing to me, how little it must be to her taste. Sir Edmund had not been so much out of the way in fearing there might be obstacles to his son's taking the step he desired. Margaret Vandeleur was an obstacle.